This is 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati Edition. I'm Marianne Zalesnik filling in for Dan Hurley. Later in the program, we'll talk about starting a small business and what steps you can take to have a better chance at success. But first, we're talking about mandated tests and how some teachers say students spend too much time on them. Joining me are the authors of Angels and Superheroes, Compassionate Educators in an Era of School Accountability. They are local educators, Gamble Montessori High School teacher Krista Taylor and principal Jack Jose. They've been writing a blog designed to serve as a resource and inspiration for teachers. You can join our conversation by calling 513-419-7100. Email us, talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
So you started a blog. Why and what were you trying to accomplish?
Oh, it's a long, complicated story. The book sort of was the end game, and we each blame each other for the concept of this book. But we knew when we had the idea of a book that was a big work, and we wanted to make sure we had something to say, and we wanted to practice writing. And so a blog seemed a reasonable way to go about that, to put our ideas out there, to just try that out in the public and see what the response was.
But what were you talking about in the blog? What drove the idea to do it?
So we felt like we had some success with students, both academically and social emotionally. And what was that? Like, how do you encapsulate that? How do you figure out what's going on and what is working and what you can share? So we started writing the blog just over 2 years ago. And originally, Jack set a word limit of 700 words on our early posts. We found it very quickly, like within a couple of weeks, I think, impossible to say what we needed to say in only 700 words. Our posts are research-driven. We want to always include practical application in the classroom. And then we always want to include anecdotes, too, because there are real children behind every one of these stories, and we want to make sure that we're honoring that as well. So the 700 words went by the wayside pretty quickly. But they're individualized experiences and what the research is behind them and how another teacher in a different classroom could do a similar thing.
Well, let's focus on the tests, because that's sort of one of the things that you focus on a lot, and how there are so many mandated tests, whether they're district tests or state mandated tests, and they take up a lot of time. How much time would you say it really takes a teacher to prepare her students or his students for one of those tests?
Well, right now, the AIR test, AIR is an acronym for something or other that I can't even recall. Those tests take each half of those tests, each of the tests is broken into two parts, take about an hour and 40 minutes to administer. That's pure test time. Of course, there's time before that where you're setting up in the classroom. There's often some time after that where you're transitioning just because it doesn't fit smoothly into the school day. So at high school level, a student has to take and pass 7 of those exams, which with the two halves is 14 parts. That happens once a year, but if you haven't gotten a certain score, you're eligible to take that test again. And there was a point last year when I was working on the whiteboard in my office to make a schedule that included original tests that one of my juniors needed to take and a couple of makeup tests where he hadn't done as well as we'd hoped. I was in a place where I could have scheduled him for 16 consecutive days of testing in order to meet this testing mandate. I didn't, because he's a human being and I wanted him in classes. And so we just had to cherry pick which was the best path for him forward, because no one should be in that amount of testing in that amount of time, especially when 16 days represents almost 10% of the school year.
Chris, to talk about it as a teacher, what do you do in terms of trying to get the students ready without just teaching to the test?
So it's always this kind of double-edged sword. The tests have an incredible amount of influence over how your district is seen, how your school is seen, that the societally shared school report card that indicates how valuable your school is, how good of a job you're doing. And teachers actually have that as part of their individual evaluation score as well. So there's this pressure to do test prep, to make sure your kids know what to come on the test. And I'll be honest, I push back against that pretty strongly. I don't know that it's particularly valuable. It certainly isn't engaging. And students are really resistant to it because starting in the third grade, they're taking these tests year after year, and they get very frustrated with it as well. So I really want to encourage teachers to look at what their child needs, set aside the requirements or expectations of the test, and work toward what that child needs and where they need to go. Because that teacher's worked with that child every day for 10 months of a school year, they know what that child's ready for. We really just need to detach the school accountability piece from this individual standardized test score that happens on a couple of days a year that are supposedly can measure everything that the child has learned and grown through the entirety of a school year.
Well, and to be clear, what Krista pushes back against is outside of the classroom, in terms of setting up the schedule, she pushes back on this idea that this testing has to happen, right? So she's talking about sort of a political argument. When it comes down to this final decision that the child's in the classroom testing, what Krista does powerfully, and I think one of my skills as a classroom teacher, is you also help the student understand that this test is in its way important, that it needs to be taken seriously, that there is a lot weighing on it. We don't want to give it outsize importance, but we don't want to minimize it either. I don't want to say, well, you tried that on that test for 30 minutes, set your pencil down, take a break, you're done. No, the idea is, hey, you have an hour and 40 minutes to prove your best self right now in this skill level. Why not use that? So it's about taking them seriously in the classroom, and it's about resisting and pushing back politically against their oversized importance in the evaluation system today.
One of the things you talk about in the book is the whole idea of children having a human spirit and sort of getting into their, I don't know, getting into their soul a little bit about what they want to learn and how to get to them and how all students are different. How do you deal? What advice do you have for teachers and parents too? Because even in the same family, you're going to find three or four kids in the same family who all learn a little differently or are inspired a little differently. How do you start every school year as you evaluate the students in your class to how do you teach them?
Absolutely. I think you've really hit on the most critical factor in education is developing that relationship with an individual student. And you're exactly right. Every one of them is unique, even if they come from the same family. And that's the work of teaching. That's why I think the vast majority of teachers got into the field in the first place, is to make connections with the students in front of them. And that can be hard. There are students that's very easy to like. They're very easy to teach. They resonate with you, and you might describe them as a joy in the classroom. And then there are other students that are more challenging, or on some days are more challenging. And one of the things that every teacher needs to look for is, what's the gift of that child, right? What is that child bringing to the table that is truly unique? What are they terrific at? And how can you tell them or show them that you see that in them? Because when you capture that part, then they can begin to trust you. And when they trust you, they can learn. I often say that learning requires trust. It's a risk. Learning is a risk. Because if you are learning, you have to be willing to make mistakes. And if you're not making mistakes, you already know how to do it. You're not actually doing any new learning. And so in order to be able to take that risk, to try something new, to keep working at it, you have to have established that layer of trust between a teacher and a student.
In his book, Know Your Emotional Intelligence, Know Your EQ, Emotional Intelligence, Daniel Goleman proposes, based on his research, that one out of every five people you meet, you're sort of hardwired to not get along with them, that you just aren't going to have the same perspectives. It's not even about differences of opinion. You're just not going to think things through the same way. You're predisposed to miscommunicate with each other. Now, think about that in a classroom of 30 kids. You know, as a teacher, you're looking out, and there are six students in there on this average, who you're just not going to click with. So you need to develop a set of competencies in yourself to be able to see the gift of every child and see what their skills and their possibility is. And that's the purpose of our book, is to demystify that. It isn't about being an angel or a superhero or, you know, the patron saint of kindness. It's about finding the way to what that student's skills are and seeing them much as we would hope their parent would see them, right? As someone who's deserving of our time and energy, who carries some flaws in there, but can achieve at a high level.
You mentioned parents. Let's talk about parents. What role, you know, we talk a little, when we're going to get back to the specifics of the testing too, but what role do parents play in in getting the child ready in the classroom every day? I mean, some families are just happier than others and in better situations. You have some families in poverty, some families that are dealing with illness and all those sorts of things. And the child that comes to the classroom brings a lot with them from home. How do you evaluate all of that and work with students that may have more difficulties than others because of that?
You want me to start, Krista?
Sure.
Okay. It's hard, right? All those things you just said are true. And in fact, all of us are impacted dramatically by what happens. When we're doing the mic test, you're talking about what I have for breakfast. Well, I always have the same breakfast every day. Some of our kids get to school not having had breakfast. It matters that your parents work maybe a minimum wage job or two minimum wage jobs, and they weren't there to get you up in the morning. So that dramatically impacts your day. To a person, we have found that parents at our school, everywhere, they care about their child, and they're doing the best they can with the tools they have to support their child. And our tools are limited by our income, by our own past experience. And a school actually is a great place. It's a great way to have a sort of a scaffolded conversation with a parent and nudge the parent along too. And I found in my role as principal, I get listened to when I say, "Hey, have you thought about making this change in your house? And have you thought about providing this support?
What kind of change would you suggest?"
It's something like, "What if you took the TV out of their bedroom?" Right. What if you made, if you're cooking dinner at a certain time at night, what if the homework room was the kitchen table? And so you're having a conversation and monitoring the work that's happening. So just sometimes just little tweaks in how the house works helps the parent have a method for monitoring that homework gets done.
And I think it's really important to establish an understanding that you're on the same page. I had a revelatory experience the first time I attended a parent-teacher conference as a parent. I'm a teacher by training. My child was doing fairly well. And I was still really nervous sitting on the other side of that table for the first time. What did that parent think about me? What did that parent think about my child? And how did that reflect on me? And all of a sudden, I understood what a parent-teacher conference might feel like when you're sitting in the other chair. And it really led me to understand that I have to make sure when I'm talking with a parent that we're all on the same team for that child. And not too long after that, I had a parent conference with about a student who was in a lot of disciplinary difficulty. This was a behavioral conference. There was not a lot of good news. But to be able to open the conference with just one single story about that child and how that child had really shown and had really showed his best self, it changed the dynamic of the entire rest of the conversation. Suddenly, we were all on that kid's team, and we could talk about the hard things knowing that we all had his best interests in mind, and it wasn't me versus you.
And that's a powerful shift, a system we have built in at the school. And it's in a blog post at angelsandsuperheroes.com called Welcome Back. And it is that we start these disciplinary conferences. We have a conference when a child returns to school. So instead of returning to school from a suspension, wondering if the teachers are still mad, what's going on, you have a conference and it starts. The very first thing we do is we go around the table and list the student's strengths. It's to say, hey, you're part of this community. We see what's valuable. We're glad you're back. Welcome back. Now let's get through the process and make sure you're set up to be successful.
We've been talking a lot in the show about how to deal with students individually and working with the parents and all of these sorts of things. How does that all roll into mandated testing, which is sort of where our topic began?
So mandated testing is part of what you might call a school accountability movement. This idea that schools must be held accountable based on a quantifiable outcome, and that every school, every child has that same expectation. And I think your question is sort of, how did we get there? And it goes back a number of decades, but we often talk about a crisis in our American educational system. And I think Jack and I both question that understanding of it as a crisis. Often American schools are compared to international schools, and there's a lot of components that go into that and who is educated where and for how long and in what manner in different countries. One of the major things that is often referenced is the PISA scores, which is the international standardized test. And really startling outcome of that is that when you look at those scores, and first of all, American scores fall somewhere in the middle third, generally 14th in developed countries around the world, things like that, which may not be where we want to be, but it isn't rock bottom by any means. But when you start disaggregating or pulling apart those scores and looking at the levels of poverty in schools, it reveals a really remarkable trend. Schools, and I'm citing the 2009 PISA scores. There are other years that that's been shared as well, and it's disaggregated there too. Schools with 0% poverty in their population actually score first in overall reading in the world. Schools with, and I think it's 0 to 25%, it might be 25 to 50%. I can't remember the exact specifics on that, but come at third in the world. It goes down from there such that when you're looking at schools that are 75 to 100% of their students on the federal free lunch program, they're ranking almost at the bottom, with only Mexico as the only other developing country that is lower.
And this is pretty consistent when you go back to, you talked about a crisis, and one of the books that we referenced by David Berliner called The Manufactured Crisis, from, it's talking about education in the Reagan era when a first major reform of education was undertaken. He looked at ACT scores, and it's very consistent. The most accurate predictor of a child's ACT scores is his parents' income. So that's the issue we have, isn't really about American educators, as we're being told. It isn't about American schools or urban and rural schools. It's about parent income. And in fact, in some places, people are doing great work and really going against that trend and being moderately successful, which what we know is being wildly successful. And the state report card, you know, reports D.
We just got a call from Helen who said she's heard teachers must teach to the test, but if the tests are based on curriculum, what extra do you have to cover?
Right. Well, that's a great question, right? George W. Bush said, what's wrong with teaching to the test, right? The test covers the curriculum. And that's certainly a great perspective, except that does a multiple choice test really ascertain all that you understand about a subject, right? And our concern is that it's oversized importance to evaluate whether or not that child graduates, whether or not their teacher is deemed effective, whether or not the school is deemed effective, whether or not the system is deemed effective. We think testing is an important and valuable tool in the teacher's toolkit. It's wrong to think of it as the only tool by which to make that judgment.
Well, and it's becoming increasingly dehumanized as well. Currently, the written response on the language arts test is scored by a computer. One of the things that computer is looking for is plagiarism. And so they're looking to see how many students use the exact same word set. However, students are also expected to be able to provide text citation. So if students are choosing the best piece of evidence from a text to support their response, they're going to have the same series of words listed in their response. That might trigger as a plagiarized response. They might wind up with a zero, even though they've chosen the most effective piece of evidence.
Especially if they've started by rephrasing the question as we teach them to do that.
Right.
And they work that question into the opening sentence and then use the best piece of evidence, and suddenly they've got 30 copied words from several other students in that same classroom.
We, in fact, got information this year to unteach our students to restate the question as part of their answer in order to avoid this computerized discounting of their response. That strikes me as a very convoluted situation that we've gotten ourselves into.
I was going to say the fear is that we move from teaching the content to teaching these skills to trick the computer or to do best on the test. And when you've shifted in that way, well, how valuable is that? Marianne, when was the last time you took a standardized test as part of your work? When was the last time any of us did? I don't know what it judges. I don't know what its value is.
As you're preparing, I guess this, I didn't think about this. I knew the tests were computer scored when they were multiple choice. I didn't realize the computer was also doing the
reading. This is brand spanking new. We're guinea pigs. But it's okay. Don't worry about that. The only thing that's at stake is our future, the graduation for high school students across the state of Ohio.
We had a call from Dean who said he heard standardized tests for public schools are not required for private schools. Is that true? Do you know?
Yes, it's true.
So the standardized testing is only – my daughter was in private school for a while in Catholic school, and she had standardized testing.
So it's not required. Some schools will choose to use it as perhaps some kind of data point or information that they're gathering, but it isn't – the way the school is assessed, the school's effectiveness is assessed. It's not the way their teachers are assessed in the way the public school system has that in place right now. And one of the questions I like to turn back around is why not? Private school and parochial school families have resources. They have income that they're able to spend on this tuition. There's a reason they're not demanding that their children have these tests. And I would suggest that the reason is that they're not effective.
One of the – and this is slightly changing the subject, but one of the things that you have in the book that I loved the analogy of is it was related to teaching and how students are taught was your sports analogy related to practice and playing the game. Can you share that, either one?
Yeah, it was a metaphor that Josh Vogt, who's a brilliant social studies teacher at Gamble Montessori and who when I came there as a teacher, he and I co-taught together. We were just looking at what does a grade say? What does it reveal and how – you know, how do we make decisions about grading? I think it's a profound question because it dramatically, like how you look at something and how you evaluate it impacts everything about how you go about it. So this idea developed that, you know, you should have a place where you can practice like one would for a sport, where you can go make mistakes with your coach. But in the classroom, often from the very first day when you get an assignment and you do poorly on the assignment, because hopefully you're being shown something you don't know, that poor grade drags down your overall average and stays on your score for 10 weeks. Why? Why wouldn't most of your homework be treated as practice, as a place where you're taking chances, you're getting feedback from your coach, your teacher, and you're getting better? And then we have larger, more meaningful presentations, maybe examinations that you've proven you're ready for because you've practiced and made mistakes. And those mistakes don't count against you for 10 weeks.
You said you used that with a parent, or you talked to a parent about it also, and the parents were athletes, and so they understood it finally?
Yeah, this was I'll say their names, Terry and Dave Tucholvy, a great family early in the beginning years of our school, and she was really upset that her son wasn't allowed to take this test. And because the policy that we had put in place was you haven't practiced yet. He hadn't done the homework that led up to this test. And she's like, well, my son should be allowed to take the test. And he should just, even if he fails, he should just take the F and move on. And that's really antithetical to our belief. If what you are teaching is valuable and important, this concept of taking the F and moving on is opposite. It undermines that whole idea. If it was really important, I should never let you take the F. Like you go to pick up your car after getting a brake job, and they're like, hey, you know what? The brake job's not done. He's walked off the job. We're just done. Just take it. Right? No, the job has to be done well. And so practice, and now you're ready to take the test. And if not only did she come around, but his scores went up because he was prepared for this test.
Now, is that Montessori thinking or is that any school could
That's
do that?
That's thinking.
Montessori thinking is brilliant thinking. Maria Montessori was...
You're not at all biased, though.
Not at all biased. Maria Montessori was an incredibly innovative educator at well before her time. Neuroscience, educational pedagogy is playing out much of what she visioned 150 years ago. So this idea of grading practices and questioning a grade would reflect on her work because she was very data-driven, watch the child, observe what happens, adjust your practice based on what you see. And I think that's what Jack's talking about, this formative assessment idea and knowing when a child's ready to test. But there are other pieces in Montessori that have moved into the traditional education sector, project-based learning, social-emotional development, growing the whole child, out of the classroom, real-world experiences. All of those things, we would say, are rooted in the Montessori philosophy.
Our phone number, if you have a question, 513-419-7100. Jim, what's your question? Jim?
Hi.
Hi,
this is Jim. I actually had the pleasure of working with Jack and Krista at their old school many years ago, and they are superheroes. They're tremendous educators, and they pay attention to the academic and the social-emotional piece with children. My question is, do we have any sense of what we spend on testing at the state level when you consider the IT folks, the paper pencil tests that are printed, the people who grade the tests.
Krista, you have an idea?
I do. I've done some research and looked at the growth of the standardized testing industry across time. And all of this information is in the first chapter in the book. At some point in the 1950s, standardized testing had a portion of the market. And then when that was compared to a date in the 1990s, that billion-dollar industry had grown by, I think it's 3,000%. It's absolutely dramatic and exponential. And when you consider that at this point in the United States, there's more than 50 million public school children in our country. And when every one of them has to take a battery of tests nearly every year throughout their educational experience, when you think about the number of tests that is, and the amount of test prep materials that are sold alongside it to assist with that, because the outcomes are so important for districts, for schools, and for teachers, all of a sudden, this industry is a captive market. How are you going to avoid having to pay for these materials? You can't. And so there's just a vast industry here and a whole lot of money.
And Tim, thanks so much for your call. I need to move on quickly, very, very quickly.
I was going to say, and the time spent, you're paying teachers just to sit around and administer a test.
Steve called in. He says he teaches in public schools, and he says the data they collect in tests doesn't include factors in real life like a bad day or student attitudes.
Absolutely. Comments. That's a great point.
Right. Well, it's high stakes. Like, you walk in, and whatever day you're having, actually, gosh, an hour and a half ago, I'm on the floor with a child in the classroom who's melting down because he got there a little bit late, and the seat that he envisioned that he was going to be taking his test in, there was another student in the seat, and the teacher refused to move the other student. And he's on the floor refusing to talk to anybody, and I'm sitting on the floor next to him just trying to process through it because he was having a bad day. He got to school late. The seat he envisioned himself taking that test in was gone, and he was unable to recover.
Now, and what would you move? Would you move a student in that instance, or not? Or is the other person? Is that just the best seat in the
room? You
know,
that's one of the things I wanted to problem solve on the car drive here. I contemplated asking the other student. I chose not to do it because the test had started. I imagine that many students, if asked, would voluntarily move their own seat if that was the only thing that was the issue. But I wasn't willing to disrupt. Here's my own concern. I'm not willing to disrupt the testing environment because there are a lot of kids in there for whom that's a high stakes test. And so he's having a bad day, and I'm going to try and reschedule his test on a makeup day. But will that impact his score? Yes, it will.
But and coming back to the original question as well, too. When was the last time you took a standardized test? Jack asked you that question earlier.
I don't remember.
Right.
Don't.
And we know that the skills that an employer is looking for are things like collaboration, are being able to use resources, are being able to learn and grow your abilities. None of that's measured on a standardized test.
That's all called, on a standardized test, that's all called cheating.
Right.
All of your 21st century skills.
And we are out of time. I can't believe it. We could go on for the rest of the hour, I'm sure.
Yes.
Thank you so much for being here today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Marianne.
We've been talking about mandated testing in schools. My guests today were the authors of Angels and Superheroes, Compassionate Educators in an Era of School Accountability. They are local educators at Gamble Montessori High School, teacher Krista Taylor and principal Jack Joes. They've been writing a blog designed to serve as a resource and inspiration for teachers. You can find information about all of that on our website, WVXU.org.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on the website, wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.